This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
United Nations and international aid agencies warn cholera is on the increase in drought-stricken Somalia as hunger grips that nation and the threat of famine inches closer.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting. We'll have full details on that story coming up. Also, a senior British official on the killings in South Sudan's conflict. She was in the country this week and says the violence there amounts to genocide. And why some are saying the Arab Spring failed in most parts of the region. Did women's rights play a role? We'll have these stories and more for you, so stay with us. There is lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a senior British official is calling South Sudan's civil war a genocide. Secretary of State for International Development, Priti Patel, says violence is occurring along ethnic lines and that massacres are taking place. She says villages are being burned, women are being raped, and food is used as a weapon of war. Famine has been declared in two counties in Unity State. Speaking to the Associated Press, Patel describes the violence as, quote, absolutely tribal and a stain on Africa, unquote. She called on African leaders to do more to stop the conflict. Patel spoke in Uganda after meeting with South Sudan's President Salva Kiir. Refugee camps in Uganda are providing shelter to about 800,000 South Sudanese. The United Nations and other international aid agencies warn cholera is on the rise in drought-stricken Somalia as hunger grips that nation and the threat of famine inches closer. Lisa Schlein is in Geneva for us with this report.
The World Health Organization reports more than 21,000 cases of cholera, including 533 deaths in Somalia since the beginning of the year. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies also reports that an outbreak of the deadly disease in the self-declared autonomous region of Somaliland has killed 28 people in just the last week and a half and hospitalized nearly 170 others. Jens Laerke is the spokesman for the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Laerke says the case fatality rate of cholera in Somalia is about 2.3%, with an emergency threshold of 1%. He says two regions, Middle Juba and Bakool, exceed those rates.
We have cumulative case fatality rates in Middle Juba, 14.1%, and in Bakool, 5.1%. So at least in one area in Middle Juba, 14 times the emergency threshold.
The United Nations reports 6.2 million people, more than half of Somalia's population, urgently need humanitarian assistance. Of these, 2.9 million are suffering from extreme hunger. Laerke tells VOA many of these desperately needy people have been reached with aid. But many have not.
Clearly, if we do not reach them for whichever reason, given that we are providing life-saving assistance, I think there should be no doubt that people will die. Particularly children are extremely vulnerable. Things such as cholera or acute watery diarrhea are killers of kids.
Cholera causes acute watery diarrhea. Separately, Laerke says measles once again is threatening the lives of young children. He says more than 3,800 suspected cases have been reported across the country this year, and the disease appears to be on an upward trend. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
European authorities say more migrants have crossed the Mediterranean to Europe so far this year compared to the same period last year. And the European Union's border agency, Frontex, alleges some NGOs are colluding with human traffickers. VOA's William Eagles spoke to reporter Josephine McKenna, who is in Rome.
Well, the European Union border agency, Frontex, There's been a 30% increase in the number of arrivals in Italy so far this year. And Italy is certainly feeling the strain because it's receiving the most migrants across the Mediterranean route. And just in the month of March, the number of new arrivals has reached 10,800. So for the first 3 months of the year, that's a total of more than 24,000. So 30% higher than the same period in 2016. Most of the migrants came from Nigeria, Guinea, Bangladesh. We're also seeing a bit of an increase of migrants coming from the Horn of Africa, Eritreans and Somalis. But certainly a lot of concern here in Europe about the increase and how to manage this influx.
The Italian government has just introduced tighter measures for registration and expulsion of migrants. What are they?
Well, as we know, this number that we just talked about, the number of migrants coming into Italy is increasing, a 30% increase this year. The Italian government has approved new measures to clamp down on migrants who haven't got legal papers. There will also be stricter expulsion measures after it was approved in the parliament. Local mayors will have new powers, and among the measures are plans for new detention centres in every region of Italy, which will house up to 1,600 migrants that will be expelled from the country if they cannot justify being there legally. And there will be easier repatriation. There hasn't been too much repatriation from Italy, sending migrants back to their home countries, often because there aren't bilateral agreements in place.
The European Union, I understand, has also expressed concern about the number of migrant children. What can you tell us about that?
The Commissioner for Migration, Dimitris Avramopoulos, says one in three asylum seekers in Europe is a child, suffering quite a deal of psychological trauma. Many of them lose family members when they make that perilous crossing across the Mediterranean from Libya. They might have seen violence or suffered violence along the way. These member states want to try and improve the identification of children and also ensure that they can help them find family members and integrate better into the countries where they arrive. There's also a concern about security, that children can be plucked up on the street and carried away or become involved in some sort of slavery or prostitution racket.
Josephine, the European border agency Frontex has raised questions about the role of NGOs in fostering migrant rescues or helping human traffickers. What's the latest reaction from the NGOs?
Well, as we know, there's been this war of words going on between Frontex and the NGOs in the last couple of months. And the Spanish NGO Proactiva Open Arms, which has been rescuing migrants in the Mediterranean since 2016, accused Frontex of trying to discredit them and also other private aid organizations to undermine them and to deter donors. They gave a press conference in Rome yesterday saying that they were very concerned and very disappointed that they were seeing this harder line from Frontex. And it's not clear where this has come from. It started with a media report in December, possibly related to pressure within the EU with forthcoming elections that we're seeing in France and Germany, very high divided public opinion about migrants, but certainly a lot of pressure on these NGOs to justify how they are rescuing migrants and how close are they to people smugglers. Yesterday, Proactiva Open Arms said that very adamantly they did not have close relationships with people smugglers at all and were committed to rescuing those migrants who are in need.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome speaking with VOA's William Eagle. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. And at 14 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. A warning from the UN and other international aid agencies that cholera is now on the increase in drought-stricken Somalia as the threat of famine inches closer. A senior British official says the violence in South Sudan amounts to genocide that's perpetrated along tribal lines. And a new report says the Arab Spring failed in most parts of the region and it traces the problem to a lack of women's rights. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. A new Arab opinion poll shows most of those surveyed oppose the Islamic State extremist group, and more than half say the terror group exists because of the policies of foreign powers. The poll included the views of 18,000 respondents, divided evenly between men and women. Dr. Imad Harb is the director of research and analysis at the Arab Center in Washington. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi about the survey's findings.
The most striking outcome, which is really very, very happy outcome, is that the majority of Arabs really don't think that democracy is bad for them, for their societies, don't think that democracy is incompatible with Islam. They think that it is compatible with Islam, and democracy affects economics. In other words, it's not disruptive to economic activity. Another one is the overwhelming majority of Arabs do not approve of what ISIL or what ISIL is doing. And this is a very, very positive thing, and it helps a lot in how to fight it and how to get rid of it.
We have two different experiences when it comes to the Arab Spring. How different was the public opinion in Tunisia compared to the public opinion in Egypt in major issues?
In Tunisia, people showed in this survey that they are freer to express their opinion than the situation in Egypt. People appear to be more hopeful about change in their societies and to the better. In the Egyptian case, people express some fears of how things are going, whether it is politics, whether it's in economics and social situation. So these are two different outcomes of the very same revolutions, and this is really very, very interesting.
Algeria and Tunisia and Egypt are more concerned with terrorism, especially emanating from the so-called Islamic State. Was that clear in your public opinion survey?
All states, all people represented in this sample have said that they're worried about their security situation, and they're all interested in whether it is their countries, whether it is an international coalition that would fight the Islamic State.
What did the survey tell about U.S. stance in the Arab public opinion?
Generally speaking, Arabs do not think that the United States is doing the right thing in the Arab world, whether it is Syria, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, or Palestine, obviously. Palestine is the oldest file here, and Palestine has never been dealt with by the United States. And Arabs know this, and they express their disapproval of U.S. policy towards Palestine.
Was there any decline in U.S. popularity compared to the previous surveys?
Generally speaking, no. There is across the board, across time, and across countries, there is disapproval of how the United States is conducting itself in the Middle East and the Arab world.
Can the U.S. do anything to win hearts and minds of the Arab public?
The United States can go back to being a benevolent force instead of being a force that only advocates military solutions. The United States has a great opportunity in the fight against ISIL to try to help Arabs change their economic situation, their social situation, their security situation. The United States has to open up on civil society organizations and Arab society, not only governments. Governments do not necessarily all represent what the Arabs want, really.
That was Dr. Imad Harb, the Director of Research and Analysis at the Arab Center in Washington. He was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. In other news from the region, most of the countries where the Arab Spring uprisings took place have failed to achieve democratic and social reforms. That's according to a new study which says one reason for that could be the lack of women's rights in those nations. VOA's Joe de Capua reports.
The study says history has shown that before constitutional rights become a reality, civil rights for both men and women must already be in place. These include freedom of speech and movement, the right to own property, and Freedom from Forced Labor. Published in the European Journal of Political Research, it says those rights were lacking for women in most Arab Spring countries. The research method was developed by the Swedish firm VDEM, or Varieties of Democracy Institute, along with the University of Gothenburg and the University of Notre Dame in the U.S. Political science professor Stefan Lindberg is VDEM's director.
Varieties of Democracy is a big international research collaboration with over 20 universities involved, many of them from the U.S. And we look at various aspects of democratization and survival of democratic regimes.
Researchers review the state of democracy in 177 countries from 1900 to 2012. They used lessons learned from earlier studies on evolutionary biology.
By doing so, we were able to uncover this relationship that nobody has really seen before, that women need to be given a certain level of civil liberties similar to men in order for democratization processes to lead to full democracy and democracy then survive.
But Lindberg says authoritarian rulers are often opposed to women having civil rights because they pose a threat.
If society in themselves sort of keep the other half down by not allowing women to participate in civil society organizations, exercising freedom of speech and organizing their own organizations and so on, then the potential of mass of people that can organize against you is only half. Whereas if women have the same liberties as men, then you have an increase of 100% of potential protesters, organizers against the autocratic regime.
He gives some examples of women playing a major role in democratic reforms.
So if we look at countries like Brazil, Chile, Peru in the 1980s, it was a lot of women's organizations that organized the pro-democratic resistance. The autocratic rulers, the military in Brazil and Pinochet and his gang in Chile and so on, didn't really think that women would be threatening. So they let them be, and they became somewhat of a vehicle for organizing against these military rulers. We've seen similar things in Africa, in places like Sierra Leone, in Guinea.
Men were perceived as a greater threat, usually receiving more police beatings or being arrested. Professor Lindberg says Tunisia is the one bright spot in the Arab Spring, with moderate success towards democracy, at least in the short run.
We don't know what's going to happen in the next 10 years, obviously, but as of now, Tunisia is sort of doing the best. And there, women were given very advanced property rights and organizational rights and so on already in the 1950s. So there you have a long tradition of women having much more of civil liberties compared to other Arab Spring countries.
He says the seeds of change can even be found in Morocco and Algeria. Democratic change can come even if women don't have all the rights men do.
We're not talking about equal with men. Maybe that's not happening anywhere in the U.S. or even in Sweden where I am. But at least relatively high levels coming closer to men's rights.
Democratization can be a slow process once it begins. Lindberg says it may take at least 25 years, and sometimes there are setbacks. But he says people should not be discouraged if things are not moving as fast as they would like. He warns that quick, radical change often cannot be sustained. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
To Southern Africa now, where Zimbabwe's parliament is considering a new bill that will allow entrepreneurs to use vehicles and livestock for collateral when applying for loans. Reuters reports informal businesses now make up a large part of Zimbabwe's economy. The formal business sector shrank by as much as 50% between 2000 and 2008. That's when President Robert Mugabe seized white-owned farms for land redistribution. Scientists are touting a discovery that they think might cure HIV infection. They've engineered an antibody that blocks the virus from entering and infecting key immune system cells. VOA's Jessica Berman has more.
The scientists at the Scripps Research Institute in California have come up with a novel therapy that they think may ultimately cure people who are HIV positive. The process involves tethering an antibody, which fights infection, directly onto T cells, the immune system cells that are targeted by the AIDS virus. Eventually, if enough immune cells become infected and destroyed by HIV, the disease progresses to AIDS, which leads to certain death. The antibodies, however, block the receptor on the T cells that HIV uses to enter and destroy them. It's what immunochemist Richard Lerner calls a form of cellular vaccination. He says the genetic alteration of the T cells, which instructs them to synthesize those antibodies, does not interfere with their ability to fight other pathogens. Lerner is the senior author of a study describing the work and proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Experimental HIV vaccines attempt to stimulate an immune response, creating HIV-specific antibodies to attack and destroy infected cells. Lerner, however, explains that the concentration of antibodies flowing freely in the bloodstream is too low to reach every infected T cell. This approach is different, he says, protecting only some healthy T cells.
You don't really care about the rest of the body. You would just like to shield those cells from virus attack. So that's the chemical principle. Never mind immunizing the whole body, just immunize the cells who are the victims.
Their engineered T cells have an antibody hanging onto their surface that prevents HIV from entering through a cellular receptor called CD4. It's hoped that eventually in humans, these HIV-resistant cells will multiply into the millions, passing on the protective gene as the unprotected infected cells die off, eradicating the AIDS virus from the body and affording a long-lasting cure. At least that's what experiments in the laboratory suggested when both genetically engineered and unprotected human T cells were exposed to HIV. Lerner says the engineered T cells would be introduced into a patient's bone marrow, which would produce protective cells en masse.
We hope to, after securing the necessary safety and so on and so forth, take a patient with HIV and arm their cells with resistance to virus, and hopefully the good cells will be selected over the bad cells. And that would be the end of the HIV in that patient.
It's an approach that Lerner calls Darwinian survival of the fittest. Scripps investigators are working with City of Hope, an independent research and comprehensive cancer treatment center in Duarte, California, that has a lot of experience with bone marrow transplantation. The center will carry out clinical trials of the engineered HIV-resistant T cells with an eye toward advancing what scientists hope will be a cure for AIDS. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, you're welcome to visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please do stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Curtis Beinel, thank you for choosing The Voice of America.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.